I'm Stephanie Gleason, senior reporter for The Deal, and this is Fresh Start. Today, we're talking about bankruptcy backlash. On this podcast, we examine issues and cases in Chapter 11 and think about the question of whether bankruptcy really is a fresh start. And so today, we're joined by David Skeel to talk about the backlash against the Chapter 11 system, why it's happening, and what could or should be done. David is a professor and bankruptcy expert at the University of Pennsylvania Carey Law School. He chairs the Financial Oversight and Management Board for Puerto Rico, and he was recently called on to testify before Congress on the topic of Chapter 11 abuses. I'm so thrilled to have him here. Thank you so much, David, for being here today.
Thank you, Stephanie. I'm really looking forward to our conversation.
Me too. I started covering Chapter 11 bankruptcy a few years after the Lehman Brothers filing in 2008. So I would say for the majority of my career, bankruptcy has not been a topic that comes up a lot at parties. But lately, I have noticed that people are pretty aware of what's going on in cases like Purdue and Johnson & Johnson, even the InfoWars case or issues like student loan treatment in Chapter 11. And it seems like to me they're aware, but not necessarily in a good way. And so while it seems like bankruptcy is having a little bit of a moment in the national consciousness, I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about why you think that might be, that we're seeing some backlash against the Chapter 11 system right now.
Well, I do agree with you completely that bankruptcy seems to be having an identity crisis right now because of the bad press that there's been in a number of these cases. One possibility for why the idea of bankruptcy brings a bad taste to people's mouth at the moment, it might just be that there's been an unusually large string of really controversial bankruptcies. So we've had the Boy Scouts bankruptcy and the USA Gymnastics bankruptcy, the Purdue Pharma opioid bankruptcy, just a whole series of really controversial cases. It's possible it's nothing more than that, but I suspect there is more to it. It seems to me that when people hear about these cases and also hear about less controversial cases, they've begun to suspect that it's a rigged game, that the insiders are kind of controlling this process and the insiders are winning and others are losing. You have insider lawyers, you can pull off a controversial bankruptcy, whereas ordinary people don't have that same access. So I do worry there's a perception that the process is rigged and it's rigged in favor of the insiders.
And this isn't actually the only time something like this has happened against the bankruptcy systems, particularly. I know you wrote about a comparison to something that happened during the Great Depression. I was hoping you could put a little historical context for a similar situation we've seen before.
Absolutely. I do think there are some striking similarities to what we saw back in the 1930s in the depths of bankruptcy history. So if you look at the history of bankruptcy, what we now call Chapter 11 emerged in the late 19th and early 20th century through extraordinary ingenuity of Wall Street lawyers, Wall Street bankers, and judges who confirmed the creative approach that they came up with for restructuring companies. So it started out as really remarkable ingenuity, but over time, it seemed to become an insider practice. So William Douglas, who was one of the leading scholars of bankruptcy of the time, he later became head of the SEC, and then he became a Supreme Court justice and was a Supreme Court justice for over 30 years. William Douglas oversaw a massive SEC study of large-scale corporate reorganization. The study was in the 1930s. And what he and the folks he was working with concluded was it was an insider-oriented game that the bankers and lawyers were charging, and this is a quote from him, all the market would bear. And the folks that they were supposed to be acting on behalf of, the ordinary people who had bought stock or bonds of a troubled corporation, were losing. They weren't benefiting from this process. We fast forward to now, it feels a little bit the same. It feels very, very similar in my view, that what we've seen in the last 20 years or so is a lot of ingenuity, is really creative use of Chapter 11 to solve difficult problems, tort exposure, or the car companies when they were bailed out and put through bankruptcy in 2009. But over time, it increasingly seems to be more than just that. And it seems to be a system where the insiders are winning and other folks may be losing.
And so what happened as a result at that time of this really similar backlash?
What happened in the 1930s is there was a massive overhaul of the bankruptcy laws in 1938, legislation that was called the Chandler Act. It basically gutted the old reorganization practice. The early reorganization practice was run by Wall Street banks and lawyers. These were the Wall Street banks and lawyers that represented the company before it ran into trouble. It was the banks that sold the stock or the bonds, the underwriters for the company. Often it was J.P. Morgan. Another big important bank back then was a bank called Kuhn Loeb. So they ran the process going into the 1930s. The Chandler Act essentially kicked them out of it. Among other things, the Chandler Act said that banks or lawyers that represent a firm before it files for bankruptcy cannot continue to represent it in bankruptcy, which made the old practice, which was referred to as equity receivership, made that old practice impossible.
So effectively, it removed those banks from participation in restructuring these companies, right?
It absolutely did. And the law firms as well. I've been talking about the banks, but there were a handful of law firms that dominated this practice. The one that did the most to originate the practice was the Cravath firm, which is still obviously a very prominent firm today. There were a handful of other firms that were involved in all of the big cases as well. After the Chandler Act, they essentially had no role in bankruptcy for 30 or 40 years, really, until the current bankruptcy law was put in place in 1978.
And so I'm curious about the legacy of the Chandler Act and of these reforms. Do you think, reflecting back, is the legacy that they were well-intentioned with unintended consequences, or that they were absolutely what needed to happen at that moment? What's the thinking on the way that played out?
In my view, they were well-intentioned with unintended consequences. So as we've been talking about, they ended up destroying the old bankruptcy practice. Another key part of the Chandler Act is it required that the managers of a troubled company be replaced by a court-appointed trustee when they filed for bankruptcy. So kicked the old banks and law firms out. It also said if you're a big firm and you file for bankruptcy, a court is going to put a trustee in place and essentially displace the current managers. That last provision was the one that in some respects had the biggest effect. It created an enormous disincentive for the managers of a troubled company to file for bankruptcy. So for many years, troubled big companies essentially didn't use the bankruptcy system. That was unintended, although there was discussion about it about the time. And the New Deal reformers who crafted the Chandler Act, I think if you said, what do you think about what happened? They might have said these reforms still were a good idea. The practice was so dysfunctional that it needed to be destroyed. But it did have this consequence, which I would call an unintended consequence, that big firms were really hesitant to file for bankruptcy for decades. It wasn't until the 50s when they started filing for bankruptcy. And what they did was they filed not under the part of the bankruptcy law that was designed for big corporations. They filed under the part of the bankruptcy law that back then was designed for small corporations, because the Chandler Act provisions for big corporations were so onerous. So I would say, some might disagree with me, I think most bankruptcy scholars would agree, that the Chandler Act turned out to be overkill, that it addressed a real problem, but it killed the patient, or it maimed the patient.
And I think that's really pertinent to the questions surrounding what to do now, regarding some of these practices in bankruptcy. And so I wanted to jump into some specific issues that are floating around Congress as possibly ripe for reform and talk about ways that they could be handled or should be handled. And the first is venue. But for our discussion, I was thinking we could keep it, instead of venue broadly, more to the practice of judge shopping, which we've seen become more prominent. So that is when like a debtor files somewhere because they know that a certain judge will be assigned to their case. And the venue has long been an issue that's come before Congress and nothing happens. But I was interested in this one specifically because earlier this year, two venues that have been accused of attracting debtors by offering a limited selection of judges changed to make it so that debtors that filed there would be randomly assigned throughout the district. So that's, of course, Richmond and White Plains. And I'm curious your thoughts. It seems like an example of an issue that is being sorted out by the courts and the districts on their own without the need for any sort of congressional action. Would you agree with that? Or do you think more needs to be done to stop at least the appearance of shopping for judges?
I would agree with that. The thing that is striking about both of the locations that you talked about, Richmond, Virginia, and the Southern District of New York, is in each of those districts, there were multiple judges that a case could wind up before. But in each of the districts, the local rules ended up working out in a way that the assignment wasn't random. If you filed in White Plains, New York, which is part of the Southern District of New York, you wouldn't potentially get any judge within the district. You would get the one judge who's in White Plains. If you filed in the Eastern District of Virginia, you wouldn't get any of the judges in the Eastern District of Virginia. You'd get one of the two in Richmond. And that strikes me as problematic, where the court judge assignment process is structured in a way that it makes it possible to essentially pick judges. And the fact that both of those venues have stepped in to address the issue, I think does suggest that some of the problems that folks have been worrying about now that have created the backlash of the current moment can be corrected without some dramatic change, without completely overhauling the bankruptcy laws, for instance. So I do take that development as an encouraging sign.
It does seem like it was a really easy fix for a problem that had been on the rise for quite a while. And we had multiple filings in each of those places that seemed very out of place. And it did seem to take the filing of Purdue in White Plains to really spur that action. So did you see it as a direct result of this backlash? Or do you think it would have happened anyway?
It's a good question. It's hard to know, but if you had the same set of developments, so that if you had four or five judges in the entire country handling a majority of the big Chapter 11 cases, which is what we had going into last year, I think there might well have still been a backlash and there might still have been a response, but there's no question that a high-profile, somewhat scandalous case shines a light on things in a different way. And so if Purdue had not venue shopped in this way, who knows? At the least, it might have taken longer before there was a response.
Definitely. So we've had these two big changes in two notable districts, and it has been pretty slow in Chapter 11 filings since then. So there hasn't been a lot of opportunity to see how it's changed filing trends. I'm curious your thoughts on how this changes the landscape for debtors in terms of their venue choices.
Well, it changes the way they think about the choice. If you're the lawyer and the other people who are involved in the decision where you're going to file your case, which would be the managers of the debtor are going to be involved in that decision, the lawyer is going to be involved in that decision, the creditors might, the lenders in particular might be involved. you have to think about the differences among judges and differences among districts. So firms are going to continue doing that. But in a district where folks filed in that district just because they thought they could get a particular judge or two judges with 100% probability, they're going to look at it very differently if it's a 20% probability that they'll get a judge that they like. And so for some venues, I think it will end the popularity of the venue. And there's a very good chance that will happen with Richmond, that the only firms that will file in Richmond, in the Eastern District of Virginia going forward, will be firms that really have a presence there for one reason or another. In other contexts, that's a little bit less likely. So in the Southern District of New York, there's a long history of firms filing their cases there, and there are good reasons to file a case there. The professionals, most of them are often located in New York. They have very good judges really across the board. So I wouldn't guess that firms will just stop filing there. So I guess what I would say is it really depends on why a particular location was attractive. If it was only attractive because one judge or two judges and you no longer can be sure you're going to get them, folks may go elsewhere. But if it was attractive for other reasons, that's less likely.
Yeah, your point is well taken. It's always stood out to me as a big difference between these two districts that made the decision. As you said, White Plains is part of the Southern District of New York. I can't imagine debtors aren't going to file in New York for a long time. But, you know, Richmond, it seemed like, well, and the Eastern District of Virginia had to go out on a limb a little bit more to make the decision that might really, as you said, curb filings in that area, or at least out of area filings, which makes me wonder whether if another district were to become popular in the way that Richmond did, if it would make a similar choice without extreme pressure, like what we're seeing right now.
That's a fair question. The case that prompted the change in Richmond, the Acena case, was a controversial case, made controversial right, because of one of the issues I suspect we'll be talking about, which is third-party releases. Right. And the change was not made by the bankruptcy courts. It was made by the district court on appeal, looking at what was going on in the bankruptcy court and saying, wait a second, this shouldn't be happening. So it's hard to be sure whether the bankruptcy judges in a particular district would make the change on their own without there being some pressure to do so. Sometimes I suspect they will, but the pressure definitely changes the calculation.
Right. And then we have Houston, which has basically the opposite rule in place. The Southern District of Texas promises that if you file there, large cases will be assigned to only one of two judges. Interestingly, I just saw that they're changing who the two judges are. So now it will be either Judge Jones or Judge Lopez. But still, it doesn't seem that there's any plan to change that procedure in the district. So it still sort of is an outlier as far as the venue and judge shopping discussion is concerned.
And it raises those kinds of issues. To some extent, judge shopping is inevitable. Some districts only have one judge in them, I think. So
Right. Maybe
that you'll be able to pick your judge in some districts across the country, or you would be able to just through the normal operation of the filing of cases. That's how Delaware originally became a prominent filing location. There, 30 years ago, there was only one bankruptcy judge in Delaware. Right. So all the cases went to her. But Southern District of Texas, the idea of assuring you will only get one of two judges in a district with more judges, that does raise eyebrows a bit. There are explanations for why you might do that. You allow those judges to specialize and things of that sort. But it does raise eyebrows whenever you move away from a random selection process to a process that gives firms the ability to choose from a subset of judges within a district.
So these issues are all very intertwined with each other. But the next one I wanted to talk about, and to the extent we can talk about it without diving into the next issue as well, is the Texas two-step, which I don't know, about a year ago was probably the first time I'd heard the term, but all of a sudden it's one of the most important issues I think that we're hearing about in Chapter 11. And I know that it's one of the things specifically you were called on to testify about before Congress. Would you mind explaining it just for those who are unfamiliar with what a Texas two-step is?
Sure. I was hoping you would explain it because it's sort of confusing to explain, but let me give it a crack. At the end of the day, it's relatively simple, but it's easy to stumble on your words. So the Texas two-step is at a 30,000 foot level to start out. The reason it's called a two-step is there are two steps to the process. And this took me a long time to figure out this is what a Texas two-step was. The two steps to the process are: you go to Texas, you take advantage of Texas's divisional merger statute, which allows you to put your liabilities into one entity and your assets into another entity. So the first step is you go to Texas, you take advantage of this divisional merger statute, divide your assets and your liabilities. Then you put the company that has the liabilities, which is often called the bad company or bad co, into bankruptcy. That's the second step. The first step, the Texas divisional merger statute, is a very unusual statute. There only are statutes like this, I believe, in three states. I think Texas, Pennsylvania, I think Delaware may have one as well. It's a statute that says you can do a merger with your company that has the opposite effect from a normal merger. Rather than bringing two companies together and making one company, you divide the company in half. And as I said, the way it works is you put your liabilities. So if you have lots of tort exposure in the Johnson & Johnson situation, it's talc, potential talc and asbestos related liability, although that's very much in controversy. So if you have lots of claims against you, you put those liabilities into the bad co. You leave the assets or most of the assets of your company in the good co, and then the bad co files for bankruptcy. So that is a kind of long-winded explanation of what the Texas two-step is. Nobody had heard of it before a few years ago. I think the first one was 2017, if I'm remembering correctly, but it's become very high profile more recently.
Yes. And perhaps most confusing of all, it seems they all wind up filing for bankruptcy in North Carolina. So
at least
even
so
though
far.
It's the Texas two-step. So step one, divide your company, good co, bad co. Step two, bad co in Chapter 11. You seem to think that this is a place that is ripe for abuse, but that generally the courts could handle oversight of that abuse. Is that a fair characterization of what your advice to Congress was?
It was. And I'd emphasize the last thing you said, which is that courts can handle potential abuse with the tools that they have under existing bankruptcy law. So it isn't inevitable that any kind of legislative change or fix would be required. But the key word there is can. It's not clear whether they will or not. They are capable of addressing potential abuses. And the question is going to be, do they effectively and fairly weed out the bad cases and allow the good cases to stay?
Right. And so we've had the first wave of information about how courts might handle this with the opinion from Judge Kaplan, who is the judge that's overseeing the Johnson & Johnson talc liability case. So the background there is that Johnson & Johnson, as we were describing, placed a piece of its business related to talc liabilities into Chapter 11, and that case was transferred to New Jersey and challenged for whether it was filed in good faith. And Judge Kaplan said that it was. It was a good faith filing and a proper use of bankruptcy. And one of the parts that stood out to me in that opinion was that he said that perhaps the floodgates should be opened. He had been warned by a number of bankruptcy scholars that allowing Johnson & Johnson's talc company to stay in Chapter 11 would open the floodgates to these types of filings. And he seemed to take the view that that was okay, that this might be the best way for these types of cases to be sorted out in the legal system. That opinion is being appealed. It was just given direct appeal. It's in the Third Circuit. So I'm curious if his opinion changed your view at all on whether Congress should take action or whether you think that he was acting in the way we'd expect given the facts of this case.
Well, I was really struck by the forcefulness of the language in the opinion, struck to the point where it made me a little bit uncomfortable. You quoted the most striking line in the opinion, which is the line about how perhaps the floodgate should be open for two-step transactions and mass torts coming into bankruptcy. There's another place in the opinion where he says, let's be clear, dealing with personal injury claims in bankruptcy is a proper purpose of yes. bankruptcy. I think the decision is defensible. To me, it was a very close call. The fact about the case, the Johnson & Johnson case, that makes it, in my view, defensible, although debatable, I think it's a very close call, is it wasn't just the liabilities that were put into the BADCO, into the new liability entity. They also, as many of these cases do, had a funding agreement that was set up between BADCO and GoodCo. GoodCo and Johnson & Johnson is the consumer products part right. of Johnson & Johnson. There's a funding agreement that arguably commits GoodCo up to the full value of its assets to pay liabilities. Now, one could debate about loopholes in the funding agreement and things of that sort, but it does strike me as a case where you could plausibly conclude it's a proper use of bankruptcy. It's not a traditional bankruptcy. Traditionally, the idea in bankruptcy is you try to restructure viable firms and to weed out firms that aren't viable, but that the idea of bankruptcy is to restructure a viable firm so that everybody is better off. That's not what's going on here. You can plausibly say that dealing with mass tort liability is an appropriate use of bankruptcy. But the opinion struck me as a bit cavalier about that, saying, oh, it could be construed as essentially saying, why is anybody ever thinking there's any issue here at all? You know, this was all silly, which I think is not the impression you want to leave. I think the impression I would want to leave is the Texas statute is an invitation for abuse, and that abuse really does need to be policed.
Yeah, I agree. It didn't seem like there was much in the opinion. He does go to lengths to talk about actually just what we're talking about now, the current backlash against Chapter 11 and some of the problems he sees with it, but that this isn't one of them was my takeaway, and was very surprised, as you said, by the forcefulness of that.
I would have expected it to be a somewhat agonizing opinion, you know, where, okay. where the judge says, this is a tough call. The Texas statute is almost too good to be true. It lets Johnson & Johnson basically decide what it's going to make available and what it's not going to make available. But when you look at this transaction, Johnson & Johnson really did provide potential compensation for the victims. Bankruptcy is a place where this can be dealt with objectively and systematically and fairly, and therefore I'm not going to kick this case out. But that's not the way the opinion reads.
No. And so, of course, it won't be the last word on it. As we said, it's being appealed. So I'm very interested to see what happens there. I'm curious if you have any thoughts on the appeal. I'm not terribly familiar with the precedent in the Third District that might influence the appeal. I don't know if you can speak to that.
I can a little bit. There are a couple of key Third Circuit cases. There's a case called Integrated Resources. There's another case called SGL Carbon. what SGL Carbon focuses on is whether there's a valid reorganizational purpose. And then what Integrated Resources kind of unpacks that a little bit and says that the court should look to see first if there is a valid bankruptcy purpose, and second, to see if the case is just being filed to achieve a tactical litigation advantage. And I think that's a quote or close to a quote. So what the court is supposed to look at is there a valid bankruptcy reason for this case to be in bankruptcy, or is it just a litigation ploy, a litigation strategy? The thing that's interesting to me about Integrated Resources is the court talks about what a valid bankruptcy purpose is. It focuses on what I was talking about earlier. It focuses on preserving going concern value of viable businesses and maximizing the value of the debtor's assets for the benefit of creditors. A mass tort kind of situation like Johnson & Johnson, where the only thing that really is in bankruptcy is the liabilities plus a source of funding, doesn't really sound like those traditional bankruptcy purposes. So I think it'll be interesting to see what the court does. I wouldn't be shocked if the court concludes it does belong in bankruptcy. It is a proper case. But to do that, it seems to me that the court would have to expand its conception of what a valid bankruptcy purpose is. So it will be interesting to see what the court says.
Definitely. So if this is sort of the beginning of some other similar corporations taking similar action and perhaps becoming more bold, maybe buoyed by the success of a case like this for Johnson & Johnson, do you think that it is an area where Congress could eventually have to step in? I mean, it's a state law. So, I mean, to the extent that that's something that they're interested in doing.
It's really hard to tell whether Congress will feel like they need to or should step in. I'm of the view that the tools are there for courts to use to weed out the bad cases. You can challenge, there are a couple of ways you can challenge these transactions. One is that Texas statute that allows you to separate the assets and liabilities into a good co and a bad co. That looks a lot like a fraudulent conveyance. What looks a lot like a transfer that is done to undermine the victims who have claims. And a fraudulent conveyance action can be brought, and they have been brought in some of these cases. There's some complications with it, but it's one way courts can weed out the cases. The other is what the issue was about in Johnson & Johnson, and that is whether this is a good faith filing or not. So I haven't lost confidence in the tools yet, but I could imagine others reaching a different conclusion. So if on this appeal to the Third Circuit, if the Third Circuit is cavalier as well, I think it will cause some people in Washington to think, wait a second, what's going on in these bankruptcy cases? So it may be that the language of this Third Circuit decision, even more than the decision itself, will have significant bearing on what happens and whether Congress thinks they need to step in. If the language is careful and even-handed and suggests that there may be a problem here sometimes, I think that will go a long ways towards reassuring people that are worried about these transactions. But if the language is different, it might have the opposite effect.
Judge Kaplan's opinion seems to say that bankruptcy is actually the best way to deal with these claims, that he seems to think that victims, in this case, they're people who have allegedly suffered exposure to asbestos from these products and developed ovarian cancer or mesothelioma. Those are the allegations, that this is actually the best way for them to be fairly compensated. And I'm wondering, what are the other options? Of course, most of these cases are in state court or multi-district litigation. Why are those tools perhaps less good, or are they as good at sorting out these issues?
Well, there are limitations of those other tools that folks worry about. And I don't follow the class action world all that closely, so I'll speak in generalities rather than with knowledge of all the specifics. But the perception is that it's sometimes hard to certify classes because the Supreme Court has made it more difficult to certify a class so that you can deal with these kinds of issues, things like the talc and asbestos claims collectively rather than lawsuit by lawsuit. So it's a little difficult because of limitations on the ability to certify a class. My sense is there are mixed feelings about how well the multi-district litigation process, which is designed to combine suits across the country so that there aren't 1,000 different suits going on at the same time. There is a perception that when you put this together, and this is a perception that is often pushed by folks who want to use bankruptcy instead, that the litigation process outside of bankruptcy is a bit of a lottery. So if your case goes to trial and you get a good judgment, you might get a huge amount of damages. So there was the verdict, I think, against Johnson & Johnson. There was one that I think that was several billion dollars, the damages. But alternatively, you might not get that kind of award. You might get nothing if you lose the case, or it may be 5 years before your case really moves. So there's an argument that bankruptcy provides a way, an alternative to the lottery nature of litigation outside of bankruptcy, provides a more systematic, and its defenders would say, equitable way to deal with mass tort liability, that you can set up a system that gives people with similar injuries a similar payout, and you can resolve all of the issues around the company's financial distress, not just the mass tort liability in cases that with companies that file where the whole company files for bankruptcy. So there are arguments along these lines, but there also is a risk, in my view, with something like the Texas Divisional Merger Statute, that the Johnson & Johnsons of the world won't just be providing a more systematic, equitable form of relief for the victims. They'll be stacking the odds in their favor. They'll be effectively limiting what people can get. And in my view, that's more problematic.
Right. It's really allowed for a way to just segment off what assets you want to make available in the Chapter 11, which is different than what we've seen before.
Yes. Some would say it's cheating.
Yes,
but,
right.
But defenders would say the reality is that you have to deal with this mass tort liability, and this is a more efficient way to deal with it. You're dealing with the liability. The company can continue doing whatever, the good co can continue doing whatever it does without being completely dragged into the litigation. And to the extent you're making all of the same compensation available to the victims that would have been available otherwise, that's all great. But that's not always what it looks like.
And so I've saved perhaps the most controversial for last, which is third-party releases. And that's the issue that I think really drove the backlash in Purdue. And I might argue the backlash we're seeing now broadly, that this is the issue that's probably the most relevant. And so essentially third-party releases allow people and entities that don't file for bankruptcy to receive a release from future liability because of a related bankruptcy filing. And so it's the mechanism that allowed the Sacklers to receive a release through the Chapter 11 filing of Purdue. I'm curious, do you think that this is an area where Congress needs to intervene? Or we've seen a lot of pushback from district courts against these releases recently. So is that judges aren't all going along with it?
Well, my view is that of the issues that we've talked about and of the issues that together are creating the backlash that we've been talking about, this one, third-party releases or non-debtor releases, is the one where there is the strongest case for legislative action. In my view, you can plausibly argue that third-party releases simply should not be allowed. And the logic is quite simple. And the logic is you shouldn't give the benefits of bankruptcy to people who aren't in bankruptcy. So the Sacklers, if they're not going to file for bankruptcy, if only their company, Purdue Pharma, is going to file for bankruptcy, the bankruptcy process should not be giving the Sacklers a third-party release, is the argument. And to me, it's a pretty strong argument. There are the counterarguments. The counterarguments are that it's much more efficient to bring everybody who's affected into the process. And so by bringing the Sacklers in, the victims get $6 billion, the $6 billion that at this point the Sacklers have agreed to contribute. And it might be really hard to get $6 billion from the Sacklers if you have to pursue them outside of bankruptcy and try to track down all their assets in the cubby holes where they put those assets. So third-party releases is a tricky issue. It's the one where I think the argument for just saying game's up, you can't do this anymore, is the strongest. And one of the things that I think has contributed to the backlash, part of it is the use in very controversial cases with very controversial debtors like Purdue Pharma and Alex Jones. Another is that courts have gotten a little bit promiscuous about allowing third-party releases. The argument always was they would only be allowed if absolutely necessary for an efficient resolution of the financial distress, that courts would look at them very closely. But in many cases, none of those factors were true. And that was what caused the district court in the Eastern District of Virginia, a case called Acina, to say, wait a second, this is the same case that ended the ability of debtors to get one of two judges in the Eastern District of Virginia. Same case said, this is ridiculous that they're giving third-party releases. And in my view, Acina was a case where pretty clearly the debtor only asked for those releases because it thought it could get them. It didn't actually need them in any meaningful way. All of which is to say, this is the one place where it strikes me as plausible that Congress would step in, and there is at least an argument for it.
Yeah. And I guess we should note that we're talking for the most part about non-consensual third-party releases. So there are releases that there are people involved in the case that aren't agreeing to the release. And what you mentioned in Acina is, I think, important because these aren't cases that are just mass tort cases or where the parties that are receiving the release are contributing a huge amount of money to the settlement. Often it's used in cases where Acina is the CEO, I believe, some of the executives that were getting the release. And as you said, it was argued to not be essential to the case. Do you think that if there was reform in this area, that there would be a lot of ripple effects for other cases where they are commonplace and used frequently?
I think there would be ripple effects. There are cases where the ability to bring the third party into the process, get a contribution from them in return for them getting a release, getting released from any potential litigation against them, is really at the heart of the case. And so Purdue Pharma is a case like that. It was clear to everybody from the beginning that the Sacklers were going to be in the middle of the case and that their contribution was going to be essential to the case. There also are other cases like that. Another case that had a similar profile, but a very different kind of case, was the Caesars Palace bankruptcy, which was a case in which there wasn't a controversy about the company. It was just a company that ran into financial distress during the Great Recession. But a contribution by the private equity funds that own Caesars Palace, it was clear from the beginning that was going to be essential to fund the case, essentially. So if you took away third-party releases, you would really complicate those kinds of cases. But in lots of other cases, I think it would have fairly little effect. And in a case like Acina, it had, in my view, very, very little effect on that case or what would have happened in the case. And so in a way, the big question is, would it be a problem to take away the possibility of third-party releases in one of these cases where it is central to the case, and you're going to make it harder to restructure the company, potentially preserve a viable business if you don't have access to third-party releases? And I think that's debatable. I don't think the world would end if third-party releases were just disallowed.
I've spoken to people who've argued that without third-party releases, the settlement in Purdue, for example, $6 billion is completely off the table, and those victims in the case never see any of that money, and that it could be completely devastating to be able to never negotiate a settlement like that for people who have been harmed. Is that sort of the parade of horribles that people talk about if non-consensual third-party releases weren't on the table? Is that, do you think, genuine, or are there other options, other ways to arrive at this place?
Well, I can think of another option which folks have talked about, which is, in a sense, agreeing with what you just said, agreeing that there may be cases where it would be very damaging to the victims if third-party releases weren't allowed, because the third party, the Sacklers, in a case like Purdue, has very good lawyers. They've moved a lot of their assets offshore. It's going to be really hard to track them down, and some of them may not be reachable. There is certainly a possibility that that's accurate in a case like Purdue Pharma. One thing that you could do, which others have suggested, is allow third-party releases, at least in extraordinary cases, but police them a lot more carefully. And one thing that you might do is require more disclosure from the third party. So require even more disclosure than the Sacklers gave, in some sort of test about whether the disclosure was sufficient, whether victims would have been better off or not better off if there were no third party releases. So there are things that courts could do to cabin third-party releases without outlawing them altogether. And I certainly would be in favor of that. And that might be my bottom line as probably the best solution. Although, as I said, I don't think the idea of outlawing them is a silly idea.
I'm interested too, you alluded to it a little bit before with the Caesars case, but another common use of third-party releases is in cases where a portfolio company of a private equity company that maybe was part of an LBO or some other kind of transaction that could come under scrutiny is able to obtain releases for the private equity company or whoever the owner is. Do you think that forbidding third-party releases could have negative consequences in those cases, or that it would, if the company needs to file for bankruptcy, the transaction would still proceed without those releases?
I guess I would say it's less obvious to me that you need to make third-party releases available in that case. It Yeah. does make it messier. So it means in a case like Caesars, there would have to be a bankruptcy, and there would also have to be litigation against the equity funds that owned mm-hmm. Caesars independently. But to me, that wouldn't be the end of the world. And so I don't think that those cases are a very compelling argument for third-party releases. I think the more compelling argument is in a case where there are thousands of victims, if you can't settle all of this in bankruptcy, you're going to have this helter-skelter effort to reach the assets of the third party. Case like Purdue, that strikes me as the best case, ironically enough, given how controversial it is, strikes me as the best case for third-party releases. The cases like Caesar's Palace don't strike me as strong a case.
And so I know that there are special provisions in the bankruptcy code for asbestos-related bankruptcies. Perhaps could Congress expand it outside of just asbestos, but to include other kinds of mass tort to deal with these sort of special kind of situations? Or do you think that just raising the bar for what you need to qualify for a non-consensual third-party release would be adequate?
I think you could do either or both. I can imagine expanding the special provision for asbestos cases to deal with concerns both about Texas two-step kinds of transactions and about third-party releases. The asbestos provision, as you alluded to, allows for third-party releases. So I do think that would be one way to deal with it. As I say this, I don't think that's necessarily an alternative to the kinds of things I was just talking about, more disclosure, more of a scrutiny as to whether victims actually are better off with the third-party release and the contribution in connection with that. You could put those things together, I think. You could have an expansion of the asbestos provision that conditions third-party releases on disclosure, on some sort of finding that what the victims are getting is better than what they would get outside of bankruptcy. A bankruptcy scholar has made that kind of an argument. So I think there is potentially room for an amendment to the bankruptcy law that could help here. I don't think it's absolutely necessary. I think courts can do this on their own if they're vigilant about these cases. But we do have an asbestos provision, and it could be easily expanded to deal with these issues.
Thanks so much, David, for joining me today. It's been such an interesting conversation.
Thanks so much, Stephanie. I have greatly enjoyed it as well. And I do think that we're at a dramatic moment, and these are really important issues.
I'm Stephanie Gleason, and you've been listening to Fresh Start.